From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The U.S. Supreme Court's latest term included rulings with direct impacts on North Carolina elections and taxation. You'll hear expert analysis of these cases, other major Supreme Court rulings, and the High Court's latest trends. A resolution honoring President Trump's post-NAFTA trade deal hit a snag in the State House. You'll learn why. State lawmakers continue to hear arguments in favor of the Second Chance Act. You'll hear details about the proposal. And you'll hear good news about regulatory reform in North Carolina, along with the latest evidence panning film incentives. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The defining disagreement between Governor Roy Cooper and legislative leaders over a new state budget has been whether or not to expand Medicaid in North Carolina. Several million people in our state, including children, poor, the elderly, are actually receiving health insurance coverage through this government program. But as we debate adding more than 500,000 new people to the Medicaid rolls, which is what Governor Roy Cooper wants to do, questions remain over how the program is actually serving those who are currently covered by it. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's been studying this issue quite intently, and he joins us now with the latest. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There is a new Duke study, Duke researchers, mm-hmm. who are looking at the question of Medicaid in North Carolina. What did the researchers find?
Well, basically, they found that, there's about just over 2 million people in the Medicaid program right now. And a lot of those folks in the more rural parts of the state, they see higher healthcare, higher Medicaid spending per beneficiary and lower health outcomes. And so, the researchers found that, this is totally explained by a lack of access in these rural areas that is leading these folks to have worse outcomes and spend more Medicaid money.
That's an unfortunate conclusion for mm-hmm. everyone, whether you are a part of the program or not, because mm-hmm. certainly this is a federal state program. So we're all paying for this and we want the best for the people
Absolutely.
Who are enrolled in the program. They're talking about, spending lots of money, but really not seeing healthier people.
Yeah, that's right. So, the main questions of the study they wanted to look at were, how and where are Medicaid dollars being spent in North Carolina? What's the relationship between dollars spent and health outcomes? And, in looking at this, they wanted to test some core hypotheses and assumptions about healthcare and Medicaid. And what those were, these rural counties that face more socioeconomic barriers, you would think that these people would have a lower baseline level of health. And another one was that in areas where there's this lower baseline level of health, we would see more healthcare spending per beneficiary. And then they wanted to test some core assumptions about Medicaid in the Medicaid program more generally. And one of those assumptions is that more dollars spent would equal better health outcomes. Another one is that areas where we're spending more money, there should be more doctors to facilitate those services. And, they really came away with three big findings that I think really speak to some of the shortfalls in the Medicaid program now. The first one was that in the more eastern and western parts of the state, they found that there's hot spots of high levels of health spending year over year, not much change. And they also found that in these hot spots, there are lower levels of health outcomes. Worse health outcomes. So this, doesn't prove that one of those core assumptions that more Medicaid spending equals better, health outcomes. They also found that, in these hot spots, the disease burden, level of sickness really wasn't much different than, more urban and more, lower level spending counties. So, this poses a question. Well, we think that, the more sick places in the country or in the state would have higher levels of spending. And that wasn't the case. And, you know, they explained this simply by a lack of access to basic preventative healthcare services that we know these, you know, medical deserts in the part of the state suffer from. And the third finding that they found was that, you know, where there's higher health spending, there's less doctors. Also, contrary to that assumption about Medicaid, that if there's more health spending, there should be more doctors to facilitate that health spending.
Okay, so this is a lot of information for us to try to digest here.
Yeah.
What was your takeaway, Jordan, as to what we should learn from this study that could help inform our discussion about whether or not to add more than 500,000 people to North Carolina's Medicaid rolls?
Right. So I think there's two things. The first one is that, you know, health insurance does not equal health care, and health care does not equal health. So, you know, there's this breakdown that, you know, just because you have insurance, that means you can get access to health care. And we see that that's just not true with these Medicaid beneficiaries in these more deserted, more rural, you know, socioeconomically challenged parts of our state, that they just don't have good health outcomes. And that's simply a matter of access. So I think
let's talk about that a little bit. So if the issue is not having health insurance for this particular population, but they've got insurance through Medicaid, but they're still having trouble finding a doctor, maybe a specialist or someone who can give them quick service. Is that the problem?
Right. And it's, you know, it's this emphasis on basic preventative primary care. They just, these folks really don't have access to it. And so they forego that type of care. And then the higher spending comes from they develop chronic diseases, and it's more expensive over the long term to treat these diseases when, you know, a lot of it could have been mitigated maybe by just some more emphasis on basic preventative care in the first place.
So what could we do? What reforms or changes could we actually could we make sure that we make some decisions on that right now could help to change that outcome, to give people more access?
Yeah. So there's some that we've been advocating for here at the John Locke Foundation, and that they mentioned in the paper. One of those is to, you know, look at what it means to be a provider. And so they offer, you know, the suggestion to invest in telehealth and telemedicine to really, you know, reach these people virtually and, you know, try to make up some of the shortfalls there. Another one is to, reinvest in the workforce, specifically with nurse practitioners and advanced practice registered nurses, because in a lot of these counties, that's all they've got. And, you know, if we change the laws governing nurse practitioners, they may be more likely to serve in these or to treat folks in these counties and more likely to stay there. So another one is certificate of need laws. A lot of these counties, the people have to drive very far away for hospitals and specialists. And so, you know, when there's not an immediate supply, you may not want to take your whole day to go up to the hospital and get checked out. So, you know, it's increasing the supply in these areas and removing the policies that, you know, limit the supply.
Here's a frightening thought as we have been seeing and hearing this discussion about whether or not to add 500,000 to 600,000 more people onto the Medicaid program. Let's just say for the sake of discussion, Jordan, that North Carolina were to expand Medicaid.
Sure.
All these new people. What about the medical professionals to take care of them when they try to call up and schedule an appointment?
Right. And that's been one of our big concerns. And it's not that we don't want these people to have health care. It's just when we're investing in one of these large government programs that's, you know, roughly $14 billion of federal and state money, we want the best efficient outcomes. And right now, the Medicaid program has a lot of shortfalls that they aren't serving these people. And so adding more people to the program when there's access problems all around the state, that's probably not going to yield the health outcomes that a lot of people think. And we now have proof of it and some good research on, you know, where the deficiencies are. And that's just simply a lack of access to these basic preventative services in their local communities.
And lastly, Jordan, we have also seen over the last months the state auditor release audits of the Medicaid program and the administration, the eligibility requirements, which in some cases have not been followed. Problems on the administration side as well.
Right. And so, you know, that just adds a whole nother aspect to this that, you know, we have a very unique state, a very rural state, and we need to rethink about how we deliver care to these folks. And, you know, there's problems with, like you said, the administration and the funding. So we need to just work together on the ground and in Raleigh and in these county level health departments to better serve these folks that are living in the shadows.
Jordan Roberts is healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The latest U.S. Supreme Court term once again featured some major rulings, including rulings with direct impacts for North Carolina election maps and the State Revenue Department's powers. Joining us with insight on these cases and other important developments at the nation's highest court is Ilya Shapiro. He is director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. One of the big rulings nationally, and of course, North Carolina implications as well, had to deal with partisan gerrymandering. What did you think of that 5-4 ruling?
Right. So the court said that we're going to stay out. Federal courts are going to stay out of fights over use of partisan reasons to draw state district lines. That if you have a problem with here in North Carolina, Republicans in Maryland, the companion state, it was Democrats giving the shaft to the opposing party. Your remedy is under the state constitution or politically vote the guys out, amend the state constitution, things like that. They're not to go into federal court. I think that's right. I don't think the constitution says that you know, you can use a little bit of political gamesmanship, but not too much. That's not really a constitutional line to be drawn. And so the court's correct to find this issue what they call non-justiciable.
Is it fairly clear that this shuts the door?
Absolutely.
Another big case with North Carolina implications, maybe not on the national level, but certainly for folks here, is a case dealing with our state revenue department hoping to tax a trust. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do it.
Right. This was a trust set up in New York State, but certain beneficiaries or potential beneficiaries were resident in North Carolina. They hadn't received the money yet, or they had received some, but no guarantee that they'll get any in the future. But the Department of Revenue still wanted to tax this out-of-state trust. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You can tax the income coming in for the beneficiaries that live here because that's part of their income tax. Some out-of-state trust that it's unclear whether they're going to be sending money to beneficiaries now or in future, that's not enough of a basis for taxing that institution.
Sounds like the type of ruling you think would be the right one to make.
I think that's right. That respects federalism. You can't have states just willy-nilly taxing out-of-state institutions.
Among the other big rulings coming from the Supreme Court was one that had to deal with the citizenship question on the U.S. Census. Tell us about that one.
The Commerce Department wanted to add to the decennial census coming up in 2020 the question about, are you a citizen? How many citizens in your household? Not asking about whether you're in the country legally or illegally. There's a debate among social scientists about whether this would decrease the response rate because some people might be fearful, even if they're in the country legally, they might be fearful of answering the question to see if, you know, that would decrease their benefits or they'd be prosecuted or who knows what. And the court basically said that maybe the executive has the power to, probably the executive has the power to add this type of question, but they need to provide an adequate reason. And here, Secretary Wilbur Ross's reason that it would be to help the Justice Department enforce voting rights doesn't pass the smell test.
There are a lot of other interesting rulings, but you also wanted to point out one that has to do with the administrative state.
There's a
couple. I mean, this is a theme that's growing in our politics, in our jurisprudence, and in academic and political discourse about the growth of the administrative state, meaning executive agencies, whether it's the EPA or the Department of Labor, all of these executive agencies that effectively rule our lives. Congress doesn't pass much legislation at all anymore. So it's rule by regulation from these agencies. And there's pushback about judges deferring too much to the agencies in their determination. So there's an important ruling in a case called Kisor, K-I-S-O-R, that was a challenge, a run-of-the-mill case involving veterans benefits, where the Veterans Affairs Administration just changed its interpretation of a particular word in a previous regulation to deny benefits to this veteran. And how much should courts defer to that just change of interpretation without more? The court didn't overturn the deference doctrine called hour, A-U-E-R, but the joke is they reduced the hour deference to minute deference. That is, the courts need to scrutinize whether the agency really is applying expertise, scientific, economic, whatever, and whether there actually is ambiguity in that regulation, that it can be reinterpreted. You know, just willy-nilly policy change, you can do that, but you have to go through full official rulemaking, not just, a change of mind to go into court and do that. So watch this space. If the lower courts in future are still deferring to the agencies too much, if the agencies are still, all powerful and doing whatever they want, 5-10 years down the road, you could see a further challenge, and maybe then the court will be more receptive to overturning the doctrine altogether.
The newest justice, Brett Kavanaugh, what impact has he had?
Well, every time there's a new justice, it makes for a new court. There's a different dynamic. Even if you're replacing, even if Gorsuch for Scalia, very similar, but still, there are interpersonal relationships, voting patterns, influence, is different. Kavanaugh, we're still trying to figure him out. Surprisingly, he was the justice most often in the majority this term. You know, we talk about John Roberts truly being the Roberts court now with Kennedy gone. Roberts was second to Kavanaugh in terms of being in the majority. Now, that might settle down, and this was an unusual term in many ways, not too many blockbusters, the census and gerrymandering aside. But interestingly, Kavanaugh agreed as much with Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer as with Justice Gorsuch, his fellow Trump nominee, his fellow Republican president nominee, his fellow co-clerk. They clerked for Justice Kennedy together. So watch this space. It's very fluid court that it'll take a while to really settle in, but certainly not the radical right term that some were fearing or expecting based now with five so-called conservative Republican appointees on the court.
You mentioned Roberts. Now with this new court, what is the Chief Justice's role? Some people thought, well, perhaps he's now going to become the swing vote that Anthony Kennedy was. Have we seen that?
Well, he's not a swing in the sense that he's truly a moderate who could go either way, and he agonizes and hand-wrings. It's more that he views himself as the protector of the institutional integrity and reputation of the court, trying to forge compromises, being very restrained and minimalist, deciding not to decide as much as possible.
Trends that you have seen either coming to the fore this year or that you're going to be looking for in the next term?
Well, it's what we've been talking about, these voting patterns, agreement rates. I'm looking to see, Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer with John Roberts and possibly Kavanaugh trying to forge kind of a center pragmatic course, not to move too far or too fast in any direction. How will that play out? Justice Kavanaugh, as he settles in, as we get further from his bruising confirmation battle, will he be closer to Gorsuch and Thomas? Will he be closer to Roberts? Be his own thing? The 5-4 decisions, this term there were 20 of them of the 67 cases. 8 of those 20 were the conservative 5 over the liberal 4, so-called. Another 8 were the 4 liberals plus 1 of the conservatives. 4 of those were Justice Gorsuch in criminal procedure cases. Not surprising, by the way. This is the same way Scalia was in these protections for criminal defendants. And then 4 were kind of heterodox. We'll see how those alignments continue. Next term is going to be a much higher profile. We already have DACA, whether President Trump can rescind the Executive Dream Act as it were, whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, prohibition on discrimination based on sex in employment, whether that applies to sexual orientation and gender identity. A textualist case. What do the words of the statute mean? But it's going to be blown up. That's going to be a big deal. A school choice case out of Montana. The U.S. Supreme Court will now take up whether Blaine amendments themselves violate equal protection and discriminate against religious believers.
All of those issues will be followed very closely by the man you've just been listening to. He is Ilya Shapiro, director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. State lawmakers hit a snag this year when they attempted to approve a resolution. It was designed to support President Trump's United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Republican Representative Jimmy Dixon pushed the measure in the state house.
It is a 21st century high standard agreement that modernizes the 25-year-old North American free trade agreement. More North American under this agreement, the rules for vehicles must be built at least 75% of the parts made in North America in order to qualify for other zero tariffs. It increases our agriculture markets. There's other provisions that I think is good. I would appreciate your yes vote on this agreement.
Some Republicans objected. Representative Jeffrey Elmore of Wilkes County explained.
In good conscience, I just really have a problem celebrating the NAFTA agreement. My area was annihilated by NAFTA. Once that was passed, within 3 months, my first textile factory was shut down, and every 3 months after that, they continued to drop. My area at one time had the two largest mirror manufacturing plants in the world sitting side by side that produced mirrors for the furniture industry. They dropped. My furniture factories dropped. All of these factories using natural resources from our area to produce and kept a vital economy for my area. The NAFTA legislation changed the economy of my area even up to today. We have a generation of people that were lost. I understand free trade is important, and I understand that free trade helps certain sectors, but I love the idea of fair trade to where we can see all sectors of our economy successful.
Another Republican, Keith Kidwell, also objected to saying anything good about the old NAFTA trade deal.
I'm a very large supporter of our president and his newly penned deal that replaces NAFTA. With that said, I have to agree with my friend, Representative Elmore. This resolution sings the praises of a bill that cost the 79th district over 5,000 jobs. Just a couple of them I thought of off the top of my head here very quickly. We lost Hamilton Beach, 1,000 jobs, Bonnie Products, 800, Fountain Powerboat, 275, National Spinning, 2,000 jobs. I could go on. I can't support a bill resolution that sings the praises of what was arguably one of the worst trade deals we ever made in this country.
After hearing the objections, the State House sent the proposed resolution back to committee. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A bill dubbed the Second Chance Act is getting some support across North Carolina's political spectrum. Republican Senator Danny Britt recently promoted it.
This bill has been worked on a lot by the Administrative Office of the Courts, Conference of DAs, as well as other organizations. Some of the supporters of this bill include American Conservative Union, Forward Justice, Second Chance Alliance, Americans for Prosperity, Koch Industries, North Carolina Justice Center, Right on Crime, Community Success Initiative, NAACP, as well as the Conference of DAs. All the groups came together after the bill passed out of the Senate 44-0. What this bill does, it automatically expunges criminal charges that are dismissed or disposed of by not guilty after July 1, 2020, allows individuals to petition for expunction of all nonviolent misdemeanor convictions after 7 years of good behavior. Expunged criminal records are not available to the public, but expunged dismissals and convictions can still be assessed by district attorneys and considered by courts for sentencing if a person reoffends. Also, one change from the original Senate version is this does clarify that for status offenses, if you have felonies expunged, those felonies can still be counted for status offenses as well, such as habitual felon or possession of a firearm by a felon.
On the other side of the partisan divide, Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick supports the expansion of criminal expungement options.
This automatic expunction provision is very important. It's very significant. Back in 2015, I had a bill that automated expunctions for those people charged where later it was discovered as a result of identity fraud or mistaken identity, those charges were improperly made and it dismissed those and allowed for automatic expunging of those charges. This makes it available for any charges where somebody has been found not guilty or where they're dismissed. It could impact probably 150,000, 200,000 people a year. It's a very significant provision. If somebody were to recidivate or go out there and commit offenses in the future, there is a portal for DAs to go back and look and see what charges had been expunged so that they could take them into account in sentencing at some point in the future.
As state lawmakers debated the Second Chance Act, they heard support from outside groups. Mark Holden of Koch Industries and Americans for Prosperity explained why those two groups endorsed the idea.
We have a vision for what a criminal justice system should look like. It's all about public safety, equal rights, and ultimately second chances, because people who get second chances and get another chance after they've made a mistake and can get on with their lives are less likely to recidivate, less likely to go to prison, and more likely to be able to get a good job and to be a positive member of their society. So there has to be a balance in all of this. The reality is that 1 in 3 people in this country have some type of criminal record. So that's as many people with criminal records as have a college degree. And those criminal records sometimes keep them from getting any type of job. It then leads to people going back to prison and doing the wrong thing. So what we want to see are more bills like this. This bill, I think, is great. It has the right balance. It's going to give people a second chance. And people who get a second chance and get a job can support their families, support their communities, and are going to be more productive members of society. The studies show that people who get their records expunged and get a job, their wages go up, and they do not go back to prison. They don't go back to those old ways. And that's all about public safety, and it's all about justice. In our criminal justice system, we do need to hold people accountable, but we should not prevent them from doing great things in the future. And one of my favorite sayings is that man should never place a period where God has placed a comma, because people can do great things if they get a second chance.
Ben David is district attorney for New Hanover and Pender counties. He testified about his support for the Second Chance Act.
We worked with a broad-based coalition of folks from both parties and from people across the aisle from us in defense attorney ranks to make sure that this was something that struck that balance, that's a very careful balance between personal responsibility and accountability on one hand and offering mercy and a clean slate on the other. If one of these individuals reoffends, their past will come back and be used again in a court of law. But it also removes a scarlet letter that no longer applies when someone has demonstrated over many years that they have learned from their mistakes. As I said, this is about public safety to us, and giving people a path forward who have paid their debt to society increases public safety. We have learned that there are 3 inalienable rights that we talk about in our Declaration of Independence, and to protect life and secure the blessings of liberty, we can't forget about that pursuit of happiness. These felonies, these misdemeanors that people have greatly impact, as we all know, ability to get housing, higher education, get into our military, and job prospects are greatly dimmed. 40% future earning potential loss on just one nonviolent felony conviction. So what is this going to do? This is going to remain in place the opportunity for people to apply for those expungements after they have been convicted of nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors. So in that sense, it expands to some degree their eligibility. But more than anything, what I'm excited about with this bill, and I know many other DAs are too, ones like me who hold expungement clinics in our district, 99% of the people who are eligible never apply. And many of them, we're talking about dismissed cases, not guilty cases. Ones that remain on your record, and a lot of people don't know it, they just get the rejection letters. This will now put the Administrative Office of Courts in charge of getting computer technology behind this effort to help hundreds of thousands of people get those automatically expunged by operation of a computer rather than the costly hoops of jumping through it in a courtroom.
Jason Soper of the North Carolina Chamber chimed in.
Giving members of our community that may have made a mistake but have demonstrated the ability to reenter society and to pursue gainful employment is crucial to North Carolina's fiber.
Lawmakers also have heard from offenders. Lynn Burke of the Second Chance Alliance told her story.
30 years ago, I wrote some bad checks and did some false pretense in a way for me to be able to take care of my children after my mother died. I was really young at the time, and I ended up serving 2 years in the women's prison. Luckily, I got my children back. A lot of women don't get their children back. But when I did get home and got my children back, I had a really hard time trying to find a job. I would go to different places and try to apply, but of course I would get denied based on my felony convictions. So I would try to go get a job someplace else, and I wouldn't tell them about my convictions, and I would go to work anyway, and within a couple months they would find out, and I would get fired. Luckily, I started my own business. That was the only way that I could find a job. So I started delivering flowers, and that worked really well for me until all my children graduated from high school, and then they graduated from college. After I realized that maybe I could, you know, graduate and go to school as well like they did, I graduated from NC State, and I went to and graduated from North Carolina Central University School of Law. I am licensed to practice in D.C., but not North Carolina, and that's mostly based on my criminal record. And I think it's very important that people can get a chance and know that one day their life would be different, that they wouldn't have to always have to clean bathrooms or do things that other people wouldn't want to do. They would know after 10 years or 7 years that they can go do something else, that they can have dreams. And so I just hope that you all consider this law. It's really important.
You've been listening to discussion of the Second Chance Act. It expands options for criminal expungement. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Jobs, jobs, and more jobs. We'd all like for North Carolina to snag more of them. But the debate comes in how best to attract industry to our state and then how to keep companies here once they relocate. Two recent developments shine a light on two different policy choices impacting jobs and economic growth. John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been following both of these stories really carefully, writing a lot about them, joins us now with an update. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
Let's talk first about the film industry. We know that particularly over in the coastal part of the state, they've got some productions going on, and they often like to tout the fact that they've got movie makers and television commercial makers in town. That's all well and good, but there is a tax break that goes along with that. Give us an update on what North Carolina does in order to try and attract television and film to the state.
Well, currently we've got a grant program that's capped at $31 million. And what we are trying to do with that is incentivize film productions to bring TV shows or movies to come to the state and set up shop. And if they hit the minimum spend level, which TV shows and movies will most likely do, then we'll reimburse them with grants of 25% of their spend.
So it's a pretty good deal if they come here, because they essentially get what I would, as a layperson, just call a rebate of sorts.
Right.
So is that really a positive step, though, John, towards economic growth? I mean, if we're going to do that for the film industry, and nothing against the film industry, that's terrific, but what about other industries?
Well, and that's the thing that researchers are finding. If we are trying to grow the film industry and we're not going to worry about the rest of the state's economy, then the grant program's not a bad idea. If we are doing this because we think it's going to be good for the overall economy, you know, we incentivize film productions, then that's going to drive tourism, that's going to incentivize or drive local industries to help out, blah, blah, blah. That's the thinking, but that doesn't pan out in the research. And what we see in research consistently across states, not just North Carolina, is that it benefits the film production companies, but not the state's economy overall.
And recently, John, you were writing once again about another new study that came out looking at film incentives. Give us a sense of what that study found.
Yeah, it's a brand new study from Western Carolina University. It's done by an economist from Georgia, J.C. Bradbury. And it looked at North Carolina's incentive and essentially said, like all the other incentives, it's not helping the state's economy. If anything, it's making things worse.
How is it possible that it would make things worse?
Because it's removing certain amount of money from other productive activities and putting it to something that politicians want to do, but that people making their own choices with their own resources would probably not choose. And because of that, it is taking away those other productive activities. And that's the sort of thing that's not measured when you think about these. You focus on where the money's going, but you don't think about where it's coming from.
And this is a really interesting policy choice in North Carolina, I think, John, because you have support for this across political lines. Democrats and Republicans support this kind of thing. Not all, but across political lines. So what is it that those elected officials, those policymakers who are choosing to engage to vote for these types of policies, of incentives, what is it that you would say to them to help them to have a clearer view of the economics of this?
Well, what I try to do is peel back the rest of the assumption. It starts from when the money is transferred, and then you see, oh, well, it's having this economic impact here. But we don't look at what we've done when we pulled the money away from other productive activities. And the same sorts of assumptions apply in that those monies would have other uses, would have secondary uses and grow the economies in all these other ways. So I try to explain how those things work.
I can imagine if you are a leader in a different industry that is out there trying to sell its products, hire people, expand, et cetera, you're probably scratching your head and saying, hey, why film and television and not me, Mr. Furniture Maker, for example?
And that's a very good point, too. When we do it that way, we are telling the other industries, well, you guys aren't as important. We really like this area. We'd like to see growth over here, and we're just going to ignore you.
John, you've also been following a really interesting kind of behind the scenes type of story having to do with another policy issue that directly affects economic growth. And that has to do with all of the rules and regulations that are in place that in some cases are so overly burdensome, as you've written about a lot, that it really stifles job creation and economic growth. But North Carolina for a couple years now has been on a track for reviewing a lot of these rules and deciding, should we have this rule or should we not? Give us an update on that process.
Yes, the process is sunset with periodic review of rules. And I think it's one of the best regulatory reforms that the state has done in the last few years. And essentially what it does is every 10 years it says, let's review a regulation that has been promulgated by a state agency to see if it's still necessary. The way it was originally set up, there are three different categories. Either it's considered unnecessary, in which case it's automatically repealed, or it's considered necessary, and under necessary, it's either with or without substantive public input. So the agency would say, we think this is necessary. They would put it out for public comment. If it receives no public comment, it would be automatically re-upped. If it would receive some public comment, then it would have to be re-adopted as if it were a new rule. So it would be subject to new scrutiny. This legislature just passed a law that gets rid of that distinction. So now either a rule is unnecessary and automatically repealed, or necessary, in which case it's automatically scrutinized again as if it were a new rule.
And John, you have written about this for a number of years, and kudos to you because you really focused on this and helped to inform and educate our state legislators on exactly this process and the economic impact of too many rules and regulations and all that. So you've got to be feeling pretty good about this.
I do, and the process has been working really well. I'd like to see more. I'm always, you know, I would always like to see more, but so far they've reviewed almost 20,000 rules, and they've removed one out of every 10 that they've reviewed. So I think that's a strong result.
Yeah, it is indeed. The interesting thing, though, about this and why it's so important that someone like you keep writing about this and keeping this issue before policymakers is that it's easy for people's eyes to glaze over and say, rules and regulations, who cares? That's just paperwork. But help us understand, John, about how this really does affect economic growth, rules and regulations.
Well, paperwork, like you mentioned, that's time. Most of the industries, most of the companies in North Carolina are small businesses, and most small businesses cannot afford people to pay attention to people to be dedicated to compliance, to the time and the drudgery of knowing and filling out all the papers and knowing what they're supposed to do. So it's a significant cost, especially to small business. And it's not something that shows up on the papers. It's not something that shows up in the official numbers of income. But time is money.
It's definitely a cost and in some ways a real drag on a business's operations. That person who's spending time on all the paperwork and the rules and compliance isn't spending time helping to develop new customers,
right.
New products,
et cetera. Productive activities.
Exactly. Well, all of this is analyzed and written about regularly by our guest, John Sanders. He is Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.